Well, alrighty then. Coming to us from Okayama, which most people don't know about. They know about Osaka. So let's say Osaka. Now, let's be accurate. Let's say Okayama. James Corbett comes to us from Japan. His website is CorbettReport.com. That's C-O-R-B-E-T-T report.com. And he's on top of this Federal Reserve thing, too. And that's great. It really is, because it's, I think we know by now, it's, it benefits some, but gee, what does it do for the nation as a whole, and what is it doing to the world? His book is Century of Enslavement, The History of the Federal Reserve. That's, well, it's a feature-length documentary, actually. It says book. I'll get a clarification here in a minute. He grew up in Canada, earned a master's degree in Anglo-Irish literature at Trinity College Dublin, moved to Japan 10 years ago to teach English, began his website in 07. And we're going to talk about all things Federal Reserve, a dastardly organization that nobody wants to audit. I think it's because they don't want to know what they're going to find, or they already know what they're going to find. They just don't want to face it. James Corbett, welcome to the program. Glad to have you here, and thanks for coming on. It's late where you are. What, 1 a.m., yeah?
It is 1 a.m., but I'm raring to go because I think this is an extremely important topic, so I'm always happy to talk about it, and happy to talk about it with an informed person like yourself.
Well, thank you very much for that. It's what do you make of all this audit the Fed, audit the Fed, audit the Fed, and nothing ever gets done? Just wait a minute. Before we get into all that, tell us a little bit about you. I mean, I just gave a brief rundown, but what leads a man who studies Irish Anglo literature to write a book like this?
Well, first of all, I should clarify, it is a documentary, but the transcript is available on my website, so you can read it as an article if you want. It's also available as an audio MP3 download. It's all completely freely available online, so that's the first clarification. But what leads me to do this is basically this all started back in 2006 for me here in Japan, where I just moved into a new apartment here, and it was a very mundane, everyday kind of thing. But the new apartment that I moved into had an internet connection, and it was the first time in years that I had had an internet connection in my home. So reconnecting, replugging back into the net after a few years away from it, I suddenly discovered all of these new sites that were popping up, like YouTube and Google Video at the time, sort of the Wild West of the internet media at the time, where you could find pretty much everything. And so I started just basically watching documentaries and things that I would never have had the chance to even, I think, discover if I had still been in the old paradigm of the old dinosaur media, where you have to basically watch whatever the programmers in Washington or Toronto or wherever else want you to watch. And so basically I started watching all of these things that tickled my fancy. And it wasn't long before I started discovering things that were just completely blowing my mind, like a documentary from the 1990s that I think is still worth watching. It's called The Money Masters. It was a big 3-hour plus long in-depth exploration of the Federal Reserve System and the history of central banking in the United States. And it blew my mind because it was really one of those penny-dropping types of moments for me, where all of these things that I'd been hearing about online about 9/11 and things about that kind of stuff, I'd seen this, I'd looked into some of the facts behind it, and I'd started to see that there was something to it, but I could not wrap my head around how this system really worked and how things could be so utterly controlled by such a very few people. And when I started to discover about central banking and about where money is actually coming from, that was a penny-dropping moment for me. And so, obviously, we're living in the age of Pax Americana, where it is the American empire at this point that really is dominating the world at gunpoint in a lot of situations. And so it's the Federal Reserve that I think we have to turn our attention to first and foremost as the, I think, this the prime example of this central banking fiat money phenomenon that is flooding the world with these Federal Reserve notes. And that affects everyone everywhere in the world, including, of course, people here in Japan. So that's how I came to start focusing on the Federal Reserve. So in a way, this documentary has been 7 years in the making, but it took about 7 months of actual production on the documentary to get it done.
Understood. So if someone wants to see it, they're going to go to your website then, yeah. CorbettReport.com. One
That's
more time.
Right.
C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. Well, you know, we've had a number of people come on the program and the last program that I was on regularly, which was Coast to Coast AM, and we spoke about the evils of the Federal Reserve, and I now I've gotten to where I just leave the debt clock up all the time, $17,907,286 million, and it just keeps ticking upward. It's absolutely insane. And how is it that how is our debt tied to the machinery of the Federal Reserve? I mean, why is that? In fact, well, more generally, why is even talking about the Federal Reserve something that should interest everyone?
It should interest everyone on the planet who has any interest whatsoever in their money, where it comes from, or how they're making it, why they never seem to have enough of it, and why they're always scrambling for dollars or pesos or yen or whatever it is at the bottom of the financial pyramid, while the banksters at the very top of this pyramid are profiting record profit after record profit, even after the cataclysmic near collapse of the banking system in 2008 that we just saw. We're now seeing banks once again returning to record profits. Why is that, and why does it continue to happen? And there is an answer to that, and it really is a fascinating story that has been excluded, I think, on purpose from the education system of the United States and every other country, really, for at least a century now, since the Federal Reserve Act was instituted and the Federal Reserve took over. Basically, this part of American history has been completely excluded from the public consciousness, and it's such a fascinating story when you really get into it and you realize that for the first century and a half of the United States, in fact, even before that, if you go back into the colonial times, the issue of who controls the money supply was the central issue of American politics. Entire political dynasties rose and fell on that very idea, on that notion. There were great rivalries that were fought in the political arena between people like Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson, arguing over the need for a central bank, the need for a public debt, these types of institutions. And that continued on with, of course, Andrew Jackson, who famously killed the Second Bank of the United States, which was really the third central bank that the U.S. had tried out in its history. In fact, he ran his 1832 re-election campaign on the slogan, "Jackson and no bank." It was quite obvious this was the key part of his second term in office, at any rate. And that continues throughout the 19th century until we arrive at the 20th century. There's a big panic on Wall Street in 1907, called the Panic of 1907, conveniently enough. And this shakes up Wall Street almost to the core in a similar way of what we saw in 2008, except in 1907, banks were going under, and there was every indication that this was going to start wiping out Wall Street in general, and basically everyone was panicking and the bank runs were starting. So J.P. Morgan comes along with his oodles and oodles of money and starts basically making it rain down on Wall Street to keep these banks open, or at least to keep some of them open. Some of them, like the Knickerbocker Trust Company, one of his main rivals, ended up going under. But he decides which banks live and which banks die, and saves the day and is lauded as a hero for that. And as a result of that panic, people are wondering, well, how are we going to stop this from happening again? We can't have this type of situation. So we need a central bank. We need a U.S. government institution to backstop the banking system and to make sure that this doesn't happen. And that's the impetus behind the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913. So in 1907, this panic happens. In 1910, basically, a conclave of some of the most powerful and influential bankers in the country meets in complete secrecy on Jekyll Island with JP Morgan representatives, as well as A. Pyatt Andrew, who was the Treasury Secretary at the time, and Nelson Aldrich, who was a senator, a very influential senator, who had a lot of sway over banking matters in the Senate at the time, and also happened to be the father-in-law of John D. Rockefeller Jr., so a very influential person with some very important connections. They meet in complete secrecy on Jekyll Island for I believe 2 weeks, and they basically just hammer out what ultimately becomes the Federal Reserve Act. And this is, again, not a conspiracy theory. This is a conspiracy fact that was admitted to by one of the conspirators himself, Frank Vanderlip, who wrote a tell-all expose in the Saturday Evening Post in 1935. So a quarter of a century later, it was all admitted, finally, and out in the open. And as a result of that, they come out with some legislation. Aldrich forwards it in the Senate. It ends up getting voted down, but then it gets reintroduced, basically rejiggered and reintroduced, and then ultimately passed in 1913. And at that point, suddenly, we don't hear anything anymore about the sort of the monetary policy of the United States, the monetary functioning, the monetary system, who creates the money, how is the money created, where does this money come from, to the point where if you ask 100 people on the street, where does money come from, you'll probably get 99 wrong answers at this point. And this is just such a basic point about the economy that we are struggling to live through at this point, that it boggles the mind how they've managed to basically exclude this from people's everyday education. So this is a subject that touches on the very core of the economy, and it has been at the central, one of the central political debating points for centuries, but not the last century. And it's interesting to note, of course, the Federal Reserve came in with the promise it was going to stop the panics like what we saw in 1907. But lo and behold, 1920s, we saw a huge bubble created through a lot of easy money that was sloshing around Wall Street at the time. And then we saw the great contraction between 1929 and 1933, leading to the bread lines and people starving on the streets. So the Federal Reserve has signally failed to live up to its promise time and time and time and time again. And I think it's time that we realize that the promise that that was given when the Federal Reserve was put in was a false promise, based given by people who were basically dissembling. They were saying they weren't telling the truth about what this institution is really for, which is to monopolize the creation of money in the country. They are monopolizing the control of the most important commodity in the economy, money itself, and that's a powerful tool that's been used to subjugate a large degree of the population.
James, this may seem like a little side trip. Control, by the way, see if you can raise James's audio level from me a little bit, because I am really loud and he is somewhat faint. That would be really good. Thank you. No, no worries. James, just had to turn my cans down a little bit lest I blow my eardrums out again. You know, it's obvious to me that obtaining a master's degree in Anglo-Irish literature has kind of rubbed off on you, and I'll tell you why. I don't think that there's any group of people on earth, any race, any nationality, that has ever contributed so much to language and poetry and literature as the Irish. Would you disagree with that?
Not at all. That's why I went to Ireland to study literature.
I tell you, they just have a complete corner on the market. And I say that, if you don't mind my issuing a public compliment, you're so articulate and your sentences are just beautifully constructed. I can really understand what you're saying. Let's go back to the rudimentaries. Most of us think that the purpose of a bank, any bank, is so we'll have a safe place to keep our savings, and well, I get paid in checks, so I'll need a place to deposit them. And it's just a tool that we use to convert our paper check into whatever we're going to put in our debit card, or we're going to get a little cash and go to the grocery store and do this stuff. But let me ask you this, in the broad strokes, for people who just do it, they don't really understand what they're doing. And I think that applies to a lot of things in this life. We just do it because it's the thing to do. What is the purpose of a bank supposed to be, absent any Federal Reserve? We'll get to the what's the purpose of a central bank in a second, but what is the reason? What is the raison d'etre? Uh-oh, that's not Irish, that's French. What is the raison d'etre of this bank thing? Why do we need one anyway? Why don't we just take the money and forget about the bank? Is it strictly for loans, or is there another agenda there?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of what people generally believe banks to be there for, which is a storehouse, basically, of wealth, so that we don't have to store all our money under the mattress. We can put it in a safe place. And I think that is, when you go back into the mists of time, where the institution of banking really arises from. If you go back far enough, you have the goldsmiths who dealt with gold and precious metals, the commodities that were used as a medium of exchange during the Middle Ages and previous times, that was obviously very valuable. So they obviously had very secure ways of storing that gold so that obviously the people who would be interested in robbing them would not be very successful in doing so. And if they were, those goldsmiths would go out of business. So it was understood, these are the people who have the safe place to store money, which at the time was gold and silver and precious metals. So it obviously arose that people would go to store their precious metals at the goldsmith's vault as basically a way of just safekeeping their precious metals, their private goods. And as a result of that, the goldsmiths developed a system where, okay, well, we'll charge you a small degree of interest to keep your money here. But what developed was an interesting system where the goldsmiths would give a paper receipt to the people who were depositing their gold or precious metals there at the vault to say, you know, this is a receipt and payable to the bearer, you know, whatever, 5 ounces of gold or whatever it would be. And once you have that receipt, eventually, when enough people have those receipts, and they all know this is for that that particular goldsmith, he's reputable, he's been there for decades, we know we can trust him, eventually those receipts become as good as the money itself. So people start changing the receipts instead of changing the actual gold itself. Once you have that system established, it's really only one step for the goldsmiths to say, hey, look at these paper receipts trading around, and yeah, people will sometimes come and redeem the receipts for actual gold, but not everyone, and not all the time. Maybe 10% of the people will come at any one time. That means we can lend out a lot more of these paper receipts, we can give out a lot more of these paper receipts than we have actual gold to back it up, and we probably won't be caught at this game. So this is the beginning of what's called fractional reserve banking, which is really the basis of banking in the United States and many other countries around the world, and is the system that the Federal Reserve undergirds. So the function, the real function of a bank in our day and age is not a safekeeping for actual pieces of paper or pieces of gold or anything of that sort. It is basically a medium for generating loans, but loan is itself such a problematic term because, again, we're conditioned to think when you loan something, it's because you have something. Maybe you have something in your vault and you go and loan it out to someone. You actually physically go and give them something. And that's what we've been conditioned to think happens when you go in for a mortgage or a car loan or something of that sort. What is actually happening is that the bank, invested with these powers by the government, can simply write these numbers into your ledger. Of course, it becomes a liability for you and an asset for the bank. And basically, that process creates money into the economy. Of course, that money is created in the form of debt, and it's created in the form of debt that is owed back to the banks at interest. This is the primary vehicle for banking in the United States. This is the way that banking really functions. This is the way they make their profits, by creating this money and then charging you for the privilege of doing so. Now, well, we can get more into the specifics of this, but I think the important thing to understand about this is that sometimes this is phrased as the banks creating money out of nothing. I don't think of it that way. I think of this as banks creating money based on the promise of you to pay them back. And you back that promise up with your work, with your blood, your sweat, your tears, over however many years it takes to pay off that loan. And so what you are really doing is you are generating money into the economy, creating new money by your own labor and your future promise to pay that back. So all the bank is doing is acting as a middleman. And that's the important point to take away from this, because at the end of the day, ultimately, the question becomes, why do we need the middleman? And is there a different way to organize this system?
I don't like it already. Yeah, it's a good feeling not to have any car payments or house payments or any of that. Funny how that's a subject for another day, but even after you pay your house off, after your dreadful mortgage, which, $500,000 turns into, I don't know, over $1 million, depending on your interest rate and the length of your mortgage. It's absolutely incredible. You wind up paying out as much money as, after 30 years, your house is now worth. So all it is a wash. It's incredible. All right. So wasn't it Christmas Eve or something like this when when the big Jekyll Island meeting occurred. Didn't they do it kind of sneaky in the middle of the night, one of those deals?
They did. It's like something out of a detective novel or a crime thriller or something. It's a kind of crazy when you actually hear about the story. But basically, yes, it was, I believe, a cold, rainy November evening that they met on Nelson Aldridge's private railway carriage. And they met at a disused railway station at Hoboken, New Jersey, trying to evade the New York press, which at the time was very much interested in the movements of these bankers, because again, at that time, the banking interest was one of the key political issues, and people were very much interested in what's going to happen, the creation of this central bank. So these people were being watched by the press, and if they were seen to be conspiring together, if they were seen to be in the same place, people would be wondering what's happening, what are they talking about, there'd be press all over them. So they met in the middle of the night at this disused train station in a private railway carriage, drew the curtains, and went all down to Georgia, where they had to transfer to go to Jekyll Island off the coast of Georgia. And the entire trip, they did not use anything but their first names. They only used first names with each other, so that even their waitstaff would not know who was who, basically. And so there was utter secrecy around this trip. And again, I don't remember how long they were there, 1 week, 2 weeks, but they were there, they hammered it out day in, day out. They were meeting 12, 15, 18-hour days trying to hammer out the perfect legislation. And ultimately, according to Vanderlip, they were surprised even themselves in sort of the amazing, the way this transpired, that they didn't even believe that they would be able to get the types of spoils out of this legislation that they ultimately did. And that's to our detriment and to the betterment of the bankers and the people who are now still very firmly ensconced at the top of the financial pyramid.
That's amazing. Let's take a short break and then come right back with James Corbett, and go to his website, CorbettReport.com, and see his documentary, Century of Enslavement, The History of the Federal Reserve, full-length documentary. Stand by. All right, we have returned with James Corbett from Japan, near Osaka, but actually in Okayama. And I want to ask you about some radiation-related things later, and just get an update. I've been completely unable to speak with anyone in Japan apart from the doctor who came to the United States and then went back to his government in the 50s and said, nuclear power is an extraordinarily bad idea and we shouldn't do it. In fact, we put it on the caravanthemidnight.com website. Okay, so these fellows who are meeting in this railway car, 15, 12, 15, 18-hour days trying to hammer out this legislation, we're kind of surprised that were you saying that they were surprised that they could, that it began to look like they might be able to actually pull this off? Maybe due to the outrageous nature of the legislation they were about to propose.
I think so. I think that's how we have to understand the sort of incredible coup d'etat that took place. And I do picture it as a type of coup d'etat that took place. Not necessarily an unseating of the government, but an unseating of the most important, precious thing that a government can do, which is the issuing of the money supply, which, of course, is what makes a sovereign nation sovereign. It's the ability to issue and to coin currency, the currency of the realm, which, of course, constitutionally is under the purview of Congress, but which Congress decided to basically to hand over to this institution called the Federal Reserve, which is one, it's complicated, but it is called a decentralized central bank, and it's a mixture of public and private interests, and it's supposed to be this great compromise that was worked out, because of course you do need some of the banking industry leaders to be involved with this, but you don't want them to be controlling it, but then you don't want Congress to be controlling it, because then it'll become a political thing, and whichever politician promises the moon will get into office, and the future of the country will be sent will be put into debt servitude, which unfortunately is pretty much the point we've arrived at now, but the idea was that this was going to chain them back from being able to do that. So it can be a very detailed and complicated system, depending the amount of detail you want to look into it. There's basically a tripartite structure. There's the Board of Governors in Washington and the Federal Open Market Committee. And then there are 12 regional banks. The regional banks themselves are private corporations and admitted to be so by the Federal Reserve's own senior legal counsel. But the way that they tie into the rest of the Federal Reserve system is... it can be complicated, and who gets to sit on the boards of each of the regional banks is there's different tiers, and some of them have to come from banking, but some of them can't come from banking, and things of that nature. So it's a complicated system, and I think obviously it was created in a very complicated way, but the underlying premise is very simple, that the control of the money supply now rests in the hands of a very few people who are among the financially wealthy and very politically well-connected. And I think that's what we need to understand when we look at the Federal Reserve. We are looking at the concentration of power in American society and the power over the most important thing in the American economy, the money itself.
What was that comment that the Woodrow Wilson made about he's unwittingly destroyed his country? We mentioned enforcing the banker rules, primarily with at the point of a gun. I'm wondering, what kind of a gun did they have at Wilson's head to get him to sign this thing?
I think Wilson was not so unwilling as he has been portrayed to be sometimes. And we should be careful with those quotations, because the one in which you're referring to is usually given, it's about a paragraph long, but that paragraph consists of two different sentences from completely different contexts. And I think there's a couple of... Sorry?
It doesn't surprise me. Sorry, yeah. I'll keep going.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's some sentences thrown in there that can't be attributed to anything he's ever said. So I think there's been a construction of quotations to try to make it sound like Wilson was reticent. I don't think he was. Keep in mind, of course, the Wilson presidency was ultimately the Colonel House presidency. This was one of the people working behind the scenes in the Wilson administration who ended up being one of the key delegates to the Paris conference after the World War I ended, and ended up being one of the key figures organizing the Council on Foreign Relations, a very interesting body which was incorporated in New York, I believe in 1921, started to form really in 1918, 1919 during the peace accords. But this organization consists of many of the same people, or at least many of the same connected interests that were involved in the Jekyll Island creation of the Federal Reserve just 10 years earlier. So we see the nature of this group of connected individuals. For example, the first president of the CFR was J.P. Morgan's personal lawyer, and there are many such connections to J.P. Morgan in both the Jekyll Island incident and the CFR. And what we see is the consolidation of the power over the money supply in 1910, 1913 with the Federal Reserve, and we see that the same characters carrying that on through the creation of this political body, the Council on Foreign Relations, which goes on to have an inordinately important influence over the State Department, to the point where in World War II, the CFR was actually contracted as sort of a part of the State Department, which worked on the creation of what ultimately became the United Nations, and we can parlay that on into the future, and Hillary Clinton saying a few years ago that she's glad that the Council on Foreign Relations is so close to her office, so she doesn't have to go so far to get her marching orders. Ha ha ha. But yeah. I think there's more truth to that than lies. So I think Wilson, bringing it back to Wilson, he was, in some ways, I think he was a bit of he wasn't the power player in the Wilson administration. He was pumped up to be as if he was some sort of great leader, and he was supposedly the signer of, or the person who wrote the what became the League of Nations declaration, but ultimately he had very little power over his own administration, and he was put into power by the same banking and law and legal interests that ultimately went on to create the Federal Reserve.
All right. So then, what I was about to ask, what does the Fed actually do? But maybe the better question would be, what does the Federal Reserve do to us?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. If we wanted to answer the former question, there's a lot of innocuous types of things that the Fed does. It acts as a clearing mechanism for checks back in the old days, or electronic payments these days, or it does banking supervisory types of things. It not only issues the Federal Reserve notes, but also deals with the actual delivery of them to banks and things like that. So some very innocuous types of things that it does, but some very important things that it does, and that's where it starts to affect people directly. How does it affect you? One of the key mechanisms that the Federal Reserve has under its power is the ability to set monetary policy for the United States. What does this mean? Basically, the Federal Reserve can create money and can take money out of the economy by engaging in what it calls open market operations. And basically, this is the Federal Open Market Committee that I talked about earlier, which consists of members from the Board of Governors, which is appointed by the president, and also members from the boards of the regional banks, which are private corporations. They have a system whereby some Board of Governors and some boards of the regional banks meet together in the Federal Open Market Committee, and they decide, do we need to buy securities or sell securities? And when they do so, when they buy securities, U.S. Treasuries, they buy them from banks in the Federal Reserve banking system by simply crediting those banks with the money into their accounts at the Federal Reserve. Or if they want to sell, and if they want to sell, they take the money out of those the reserves of those banks. So by doing that, they're actually taking money out of or putting money into the economy itself. And they try to target something called the federal funds rate, which is the interest rate that they want to. They have a target. They can't directly set this, but they say we're going to target a federal funds rate of 2% or whatever. And this is the rate at which banks are going to lend to each other. And ultimately, this has the knock-on effect of how much it's going to cost you if you go to the bank and ask for a loan, because they are tied to things like the federal funds rate. So they have a large degree of control over how much money is going into the economy or coming out of the economy, and really the price of money. I mean, that's the way to think about interest rates. When you go to the bank for a loan, is the price of that money going to be very high or is it going to be very low? And this can have exceptionally important effects on the economy overall, as we saw last decade, where Bubbles Greenspan, the former chairman of the Federal Reserve, he instituted a policy of very, very, very low interest rates, and he kept them there for a very long time. So basically, we had the popping of the dot-com bubble in 99, 2000. After that, it looked like it was going to be a disaster. Obviously, there was going to have to be a recession and some severe pain in the economy. 9/11 comes along, obviously even more pain in the economy. So what does he do? He sets interest rates as low as possible. It's very cheap. Money is very cheap, so people can borrow more. Debt levels start going up. All of this money sloshing around the economy, where's it going to go? It starts going into housing. Suddenly, housing market's booming. Oh, you're going to make so much money. Flip a house, buy a second house, buy a third house. It's going to be great. You're going to make all sorts of money. Look, the housing market's just going up and up. And housing markets never decline overall on nationwide. That's never happened in history, so you're fine. Of course, what ultimately ends up happening, we have the subprime fiasco and the derivatives based on these mortgage-backed securities, these toxic derivative, basically garbage that's being sold by banks and bet against by the same banks that are selling these bundles. And all of this mess is going on under the Federal Reserve's watch. And ultimately, what ends up happening, of course, we see the incredible cataclysm that happens with the popping of the subprime bubble and the Lehman Brothers collapse and everything that's going to eventuate from that. So what do they end up doing to solve the problem that they themselves created? They create an even bigger problem. They start the quantitative easing, quantitative easing 1, quantitative easing 2, quantitative easing 3, throwing money at the problem to try to basically stop the gaping black hole of debt obligations that's starting to open up, seeing if they can shove enough money down there to stop that maw from opening up. And they certainly have managed to kick that can down the road several years. But what they've done is, according to a key official at the Bank of England, is they've created, quote, the biggest debt bubble, the biggest bond bubble in history. So basically, we've seen the Federal Reserve buying all of these bonds. We've seen the Bank of England buying all of these bonds. We've seen the Bank of Japan, all of these various quantitative easings, buying bonds, skewing the bonds markets. skewing the equities market. So now we have the Dow Jones and the S&P hitting high after high after high, record high. And where is this ultimately leading? Exactly to another crash. But this time, the crash is going to be even bigger than the last time. Every time they try to blow up another bubble to save ourselves from the last one, the problem gets worse. So there's the dot-com bubble, the subprime housing bubble, and the next bubble, the bond bubble, to burst, which when that bursts, I think we're going to see some very significant pain. And that's why I think it's important to get the truth about the Federal Reserve banking system and what we can do to get around and away from this system out now, before the pain really starts to set in, because I think there are real alternatives that people can start turning to right now to get away from the Federal Reserve notes that they have in their pocket and towards other systems that that will hopefully be the types of structures that will see us through whatever the popping of the next bubble will look like.
Let me ask you this, James. Who profits from these popping giant bubbles? Somebody makes money when the economy contracts. Who is it, or what is it?
It's quite simple. It's the, again, it's the banking elite that ends up making money from this. And it's not all bankers. I mean, of course, we're not painting the big broad brush here. And there are banks that go under, and it's a game of economic warfare between the bankers as well. But ultimately, who are the people who are making money are the people who are most politically and financially connected. So when you look at something like the New York branch of the Federal Reserve, which is really one of the, probably the key to the Federal Reserve system. It's the most powerful of the regional banks, and it basically represents the banks on Wall Street. On the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, you find obviously some of the most important Wall Street players, people like Jamie Dimon and others, very connected corporate and banking interests. And on that board, the people who were sitting on that board during the last bailout and collapse got to play around with trillions of dollars. Of course, we were all told about the $700 billion from Congress, and we were all focusing on that number. Meanwhile, the Federal Reserve was engaging in emergency lending and emergency operations that totaled up to $29 trillion worth of emergency operations, according to one estimate from, I want to say, the University of Chicago. I can't remember, but there was a study that came out that estimated $29 trillion in total emergency bailout lending and emergency funds that were provided by the Federal Reserve. $16 trillion of that was audited by the Government Accountability Office back in 2011 in a pretty stunning report that talked about the blatant conflicts of interest between the people who were sitting on the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, who were deciding where all of these hundreds of billions of dollars were going to go, and the institutions that they were actually sitting on. So, for example, someone like a Jamie Dimon is, at the time that he's on the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, he's directing literally hundreds of billions of dollars in emergency lending to his own bank. Or you have someone like Jeffrey Immelt of GE, who's directing billions of dollars in emergency lending towards GE. And again, I mean, these types of blatant conflicts of interest exist, and they were even pointed out in this report, but very little comes of it politically. And the question is, why would this be? And the answer is obviously because, again, it's not necessarily the congressmen and senators who were in charge of this system. It's the people who have the purse strings of the nation itself.
How is it that the... let me ask you a question. This is a really, really simple question. But what is a bond? When we say that England's buying up bonds, or this country or that country or this outfit or that outfit is buying up our bonds, what is this bond, and what is its reason for being? What does it? Why do they exist?
This is such an important question that people should be asking, because this is, I mean, really the mechanism of how the Federal Reserve functions by feeding the debt beast, which the U.S. government uses as its lifeblood. So the U.S. government can actually issue notes like the Federal Reserve notes. They could issue Treasury notes that would be dollars, pieces of paper that would function just like what you see, except they would not be based on debt. The way the system actually functions, though, is the U.S. government takes the same authority and gravitas that it uses to issue these IOUs and that it would use to issue treasury notes, and it issues basically IOUs, which are bonds, securities. They come in different different terms. You can get 1 year or 5 year or 10 year. There are different way terms that they're delimited on, but they're basically the U.S. government is guaranteeing after 1 year or 5 years or 10 years or whatever it is, we will give you such and such percentage interest on this. So it's a safe way to invest your money, and it's obviously used by pension funds and others as a safe and reliable investment because everyone knows the U.S. government is good for its debt and it will deliver. It always pays its debt, so it's a very safe investment that people can basically benchmark as a benchmark. But the insanity of the system is the U.S. government issues these treasuries and the Federal Reserve ends up buying them, and that's how the money gets injected into the system. The U.S. Treasury issues these securities, these bonds, as IOUs out to China and to Japan and whoever else is buying them, anyone else who will buy them, and that's the way it gets its money to fund its operations. But it could simply issue the notes themselves. There's no reason why it has to issue these IOUs other than because it does benefit the banking system that ultimately gets to create the money and then buy the IOUs from the government. Well, in the situation of you're lending money to someone, who's in control there? Who actually is the one that is in the power seat of that relationship? It's clearly the one who is lending, not the one who is borrowing. Neither a borrower nor a lender be, as the great bard would say. And I think that's something that the U.S. government, with a snap of its fingers, could change tomorrow if it wanted to, but clearly it doesn't want to. It has handed that power of issuing the money over to the Federal Reserve.
All right, now, man, you're sending my head spinning upwards. What kind of what component is ongoing warfare in finance?
I'm not sure I get the question.
Well, it seems like the United States, for example, has been involved in all these regional conflicts going all the way back to Vietnam. And I remember during the Vietnam era, everyone was abuzz about getting a pretty decent paying job at these various aircraft factories and bomb making facilities and all kinds of stuff. And I'm just wondering, does warfare, all these, like this continual involvement in the Middle East, are these things being, I'm trying to find out if these things are actually being started, fomented in order to contribute to the, with quotes around the word, health of our economy, if this is another version of derivatives, so to speak.
Right. No, I see what you're saying, and I fully agree with that assessment. If war is the health of the state, I think it's also the lifeblood of the economy at this point. Obviously, it doesn't have to be, but that's the system that we're functioning in. So that, as one example, if you looked at the overall profits of the military, the major military industrial contractors, the Boeings and the Lockheed Martins and the like, in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union for that 10-year period, you see that profits are way down, sales are way down. Of course, what happens on 9/11 and the beginning of the Afghan war and then leading into the Iraq war and into the continuing insanity in the Middle East that we see today, profits begin spiking again. There's obviously there are people who profit, directly profit, and make billions upon billions upon billions of dollars from warfare. And the idea that connecting that profit incentive to people actually conspiring to make those types of warfare situations happen, the idea that this is some sort of outlandish conspiracy theory is just a remarkable psychological operation that's been perpetrated on the public to keep them from understanding one of the most basic principles of power, which is that power always seeks to consolidate itself and always seeks to expand its control over the economy, over the people in general. Because I think at the end of the day, that's the thing that we have to understand about the Federal Reserve System and the economy generally. It's not about dollars and cents. It's not about numbers in a bank account, because ultimately, as we know, those numbers are just created by the bank with a flick of their pen, and they could take them out of the economy if they wanted to as well. It's not the dollars and cents that matter. It's the power that comes with that. It's the power, for example, to hold people in their sway, in debt servitude, for however many years or decades it takes to pay off their loans, chained to a system whereby you have to be on that corporate treadmill or whatever it is in order, because you have a car payment, you have a house payment, you've got kids to feed. You have to do things that you don't want to do simply because, well, that's the way the system is, and we're indebted to these people. So there is, at the end of the day, it is about the power to control people's lives, and that's such a remarkable and mind-boggling thing that if we even start to think about that, I think it starts to open that Pandora's box, which is why the bread and circuses are just off the charts these days to distract people, get them thinking about absolutely anything other than what they're actually living through day to day and what they're actually doing and sacrificing in order to simply make ends meet, while the military industrial and the bankers and everyone else make profit, profit after record profit.
Hang tough just one second, and we'll return a most singular conversation with Mr. James Corbett. Check out his documentary, You Must Do It, CorbettReport.com, here on the eve of Guy Fawkes Day. We'll get to that in a minute, too. This is Caravan to Midnight. Stand by. James Corbett, I got to tell you, I'm really enjoying this conversation because many of the components in our chat today have been stated, and they've been restated by various people who are in fact learned and they're very serious authors, very serious researchers, and all of that. But you know, in the same way that the English language is so incredibly descriptive. I don't know if you agree with this, but I think it is the most descriptive language on the face of the earth. There are so many different ways to describe the same thing. And anyway, your case is really solid. I'm just enjoying listening to you make it. Now let me ask you this. Is there a snowball's chance in Hades of ever auditing the Fed or actually making the Fed go away?
Well, I guess those are two separate questions. And yes, on the first question, I think there is a chance that you could open the coffers a little bit and see under the hood to some of the dirty dealings that it does. And there are various ways that could happen. Bloomberg filed a lawsuit during the bailout time to try to open up some of the basically, where is this money going? What central banks, what foreign banks are being bailed out by the Federal Reserve and that type of thing. So there was those types of legal battles going on. There was the GAO with its Government Accountability Office report showing a little bit. There are bits and pieces scattered around that you can find about some of these numbers. So I don't think it's completely unknowable, and I don't think it's completely opaque. And there may be a time, if the political backlash is large enough, that they'll sort of make a show of opening the books a little bit more broadly. But again, I think that the system is so complicated for the average person who, again, just wants to go home and sort of veg out after a hard day's work, that it's not necessarily clear that simply opening the books would really be the end. I applaud the sort of the spirit of the audit the Fed legislation, though, insofar as I think it's an educational tool to at least get people, get that foot in the door for the conversation about the Federal Reserve. What does it do and why does it exist, I think, are the fundamental issues that we have to be grappling with. And if this offers sort of that portal so that people can at least be introduced to the subject and we can talk about it a little bit more openly, then that's for the better. I don't expect much to actually eventuate from this legislation, even if it does get passed. But I think that the conversation is probably the more important part of this, because if you look back 100-150 years ago, there were widespread protests and political movements, and the populists and William Jennings Bryan and all of these great political dynasties and fortunes rose and fell on the back of the people's outrage, basically, over the banking sector and how they were being plundered and swindled. And if we are on the verge of a similar moment, we saw some of that occurring in 2008, 2009, 2010, partly because of the efforts of people like Ron Paul, partly because of just the natural reaction to the bailouts and the billions and trillions that ultimately ended up going to the banks. There was a bit of that outrage and a bit of that sense of the revolutionary moment sort of returned, I think, to the American political landscape. And it is the question of whether we can really capture that and use that momentum to do something positive with it. And so, again, I think it's about opening the conversation and educating people about the real alternatives that, again, really do exist to the Federal Reserve System that exist already right now. People don't have to go out and create them from scratch. A lot of them already exist in various ways that people can just start tapping into and just start whittling away at the Federal Reserve's monopoly over people's minds and hearts and wallets.
If we were to be able to replace the Fed, and then the reason that was a kind of a two-part question, you said those are separate questions, I'm thinking that an audit of the Fed would probably result in it going away. I think if it were ever, I just think this, I don't know, but I'm thinking that if it were ever audited and if the result of that audit were ever revealed, somebody, and maybe more than just a bunch of somebodies would say, you know what, I think we're done here. I think this has had its run, and I think we need a new system if we were to replace it. What do you envisage as a system that would replace it or could replace it?
Well, I think the way to understand and envision the system that would replace this is to maybe change the wording a little bit. Rather than replace, I think supplant is more of the idea that we want. We don't necessarily have to even go about the political process of abolishing the Federal Reserve before we start actually supplanting the Federal Reserve. And I think that there are obviously people who have very strong dogmatic opinions one way or another. It has to be a gold-backed money, or it has to be a government issuing debt-free money through Congress, or it has to be this, or it has to be that. I am not nearly so dogmatic as that, because I see one of the central problems of the Federal Reserve is that it is that centralization and that monopolization of the money supply itself. If we want to effectively combat that, how are we going to do that by just putting in another a centralized, monopolized system of control? I think that the answer is really to split it up and to open that box and really realize that there are many, many different ways of transacting with each other in the economy. And why on earth would I want to use the exact same currency in a transaction that I'm doing face-to-face with someone in a local farmer's market and in a national chain store and online? All of these different types of ways that we transact, why do we need the same type of currency? And there are so many different ideas out there that I think, really, the more the merrier. I think we should have a little bit of here, a little bit of there. Don't put your eggs in one basket is a saying that we teach our children because we think it's good sense in a lot of ways. Why don't we think it's good monetary sense? Again, I don't think there is a single system that's going to be perfect or that's unmanipulatable, but I think it's the competition between various different forms that really is the possibility of, again, supplanting the Federal Reserve. Because I think there's a way that we can envisage people starting to work around the Federal Reserve and work through alternative and complementary currencies and cryptocurrencies and precious metals and other ways of transacting with each other that starts to basically whittle away at the Federal Reserve's control over the money supply. It's not that we're going to completely get rid of the US dollar overnight, but it is a process whereby people can start finding other ways to harness, again, the central power of the economy is not the bank's ability to flick a pen and make money appear. The central power of the economy is the labor, the people that actually sweat and labor and pour their blood and sweat and tears into their whatever it is they're doing, that is the basis for this money creation. And that's really where the productive power of the economy comes from. It's, again, it's the people. So if we start harnessing some of that power for our own purposes and for what we want to build up as communities, rather than basically signing that off to the bankers as middlemen, then we could really, there is a true sense in which we could have a renaissance that would certainly rival anything that we've seen before in human history. And it's, again, it's just the question of finding that key or those keys that will unlock the debt chains of the bankers.
Let's take a little side trip here. Russia's rattling its chains. There's a big guy, you know, we got this BRICS thing coming. There's been a move to, they would really like to take the dollar out of its role as the world's reserve currency and make the petrodollar go away and all of that. But I understand that Japan is a, where you are, is has a role in this, it's sort of a new Cold War that's, I think it's backed up with the airplanes and incursions here and there by Mr. Putin's forces, but it's all about money in the end. So what is Japan's role in this like this emerging U.S.-Russia Cold War scenario that seems to be forming?
Well, since the end of the Second World War, Japan has been nothing other than a proxy for the U.S. government in the Asia-Pacific region, and it's played that role very well, and I think has been rewarded very well for playing that role subserviently for many years, so that cooperating with the U.S. in the U.S. Security Pact and doing things like allowing the U.S. to use Japan as a place to ship and store and transport its nuclear weapons, despite the fact that the prime ministers here have made a big show of this being a nuclear free country and the three nuclear principles or whatever. All of this we find out years later from declassified documents. It was all lies. It was all they just said, yes, sir, Mr. Uncle Sam, whatever you want. So as a result of that, they've been rewarded very well with the what was formerly the second largest economy in the world, now the third largest as China starts to rise. But I think that's really the key of the shift that's happening right now. It's now China is the second largest economy in the world and starting to overtake the United States and projected to do so within the next decade at least. So so we are seeing a really seismic shift going on right now. And Japan continues, of course, to be basically a proxy for the U.S. in its Asia-Pacific pivot that was announced by Clinton and others in the Pentagon a few years ago. The question is there a tipping point at which Japan could feasibly leave the orbit of the United States and realize that it would probably be better situated in the orbit of China, a rising China? That's pretty much politically unthinkable at this point in time, but I think that that's the type of thing that at least becomes ponderable in this sort of new economic Cold War that's happening right now and the potential military Cold War that we see shaping up in the future. And those are the types of questions that I think we're going to be grappling with in the coming decade or two decades, where I think we really start to see the eclipsing of the U.S. economy. And again, I think that this has to be seen in a much larger framework. Of course, what we are seeing right now is from the nation-state perspective. It's the U.S. versus China and Russia and NATO versus the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. But I think there is a level above that at which basically nation states are being played off against each other for the eventual creation of a global governmental system and a global currency of some sort. And if that is the game plan, I think it's working remarkably well, because we are heading almost inevitably towards that type of fracture, especially now that that Russia has been so cornered and sanctioned that it is now desperately trying to find ways to become closer to its Asian friends like China, who has not been a friend of Russia for a long time, but they're starting to cozy up as a result of this. And of course, China is now desperately seeking resources all around the world and basically doing anything it can to get its foot into Africa and other places. So I think this is coming to a head, and it will come to the head in the next decade or two as we move into the realm where the U.S. Dollar starts to really lose its position as world reserve currency, which is a very long way of answering the question, but I hope I managed to do it.
Well, you know, when you build a big engine and if you intend to run it, you're going to need fuel. And I just wonder if maybe China has not built an engine that's so big. I mean, you just said they're desperately seeking resources and all over the world. And I'm just wondering if maybe anybody pulls back from that voracious appetite for fuel, for this big engine, this big economic engine that they've built, if that's not going to wind up being as it has in history, maybe that's going to be the thing that causes the big problem. They're not squeamish about rattling their sabers or flexing their muscles.
Well, again, this comes back to what was what you were talking about earlier, the petrodollar, which, of course, is the idea that back in the 1970s, after Nixon officially took the U.S. dollar off the gold peg, and suddenly the U.S. dollar was just whatever the U.S. government said it was. Well, what's really backing it up? And, of course, Kissinger, being the real man behind Nixon, set up the system, basically brokered a deal with the Saudis that, you know, we'll protect you, we'll be your musclemen in the region, and and you'll price your oil in dollars, and you will launder basically buy U.S. treasuries with that, with those dollars, and that's the circle by which this is the U.S. dollar has maintained its hegemony over the world system for the past four decades. That is in danger, real danger of coming to an end for a lot of different reasons, but something that's happened in the last year that's particularly interesting is that Saudi-U.S. cement, which is the glue that holds the petrodollar together, seems to be loosening at any rate. There has been some squeaking and squawking from the Saudis about the U.S. relationship and the U.S. reticence to go into Syria that caused some strains, and we've seen some cozying up between China and Saudi Arabia. China has recently become the world's largest importer of oil, and the Saudis are probably looking at that and realizing which side their bread is buttered on in the long term. So again, if we start to see the U.S.-Saudi alliance coming apart at the seams, that's another nail in the coffin of the U.S. dollar as a world reserve.
Oil prices hitting a four-year low after a Saudi discount, and then dollar at a four-year high. Correlation here somehow?
Well, there's a lot of things that are going on economically, and obviously oil and the dollar are tied together, but I think the key things to note is that the oil price falling is because of Saudi Arabia has basically opened up the spigot, and that is interestingly part of a deal that's been brokered between Saudis and the U.S. Basically, the U.S. is supporting now the bombing of Syria and Assad, which of course is the Saudis' main enemy in the region and something that they've been lobbying for years. They do a little back scratching. Well, we'll keep pumping the oil and we'll get the oil price down. Who does that ultimately hurt the most? It's countries like Iran and Venezuela and Russia, which have a break-even point for their budgets of over $100 a barrel oil. So basically, I think Iran is at $140 a barrel oil. If it has $140 a barrel oil, it can fulfill its budget, the national budget that the government has set. Russia is somewhere in the $100 range. Venezuela is up there as well, $120 maybe. All, of course, targets of the U.S. State Department and countries that they want to target economically. So the people who are being basically short-squeezed by this are some of the U.S.'s biggest foes. So, again, I think the Saudis have done a little bit of that. The reason the U.S. dollar is so strong right now is a couple of things. First of all, the important thing to note about the relative value of money on the global exchanges is that it is 100% about perception. So there is a market perception right now that there's a strengthening of the dollar because the Federal Reserve has eased off the gas pedal and said we're not going to do any more QE, and we might even raise interest rates. It's a strong dollar policy, which is ridiculous when you look at the way they've ballooned and mushroomed their balance books, their balance sheets in the last few years. It's ridiculous. But the markets perceive that there's a strengthening, so they flock to that. And secondly, it's the best looking house on a bad block. I mean, who's it competing against? The euro, the yen, which here in Japan, they just announced a stunning acceleration of the quantitative easing here in Japan. They're going to ramp it up to 80 trillion yen for the year from a projected 50 trillion yen of new money that they're putting into the economy. They're going to triple their REIT and ETF purchases. So they're going crazy with the printing here in Japan. Again, there's just no rival for the U.S. dollar at this point, which is why it's doing so extremely well, and it seems to be strengthening. But I think, again, that's very deceptive because it doesn't show the underlying geopolitical reality that we're talking about that's coming into view.
You know what? Let me ask you this. What about the resentments? Do resentments still linger between Japan and China over that whole, you know, things like World War II, Nanking, and, you know, the Russians and the Japanese were at war for a while? I mean, do those tensions and those resentments linger? I can't imagine that they don't.
Oh, they certainly do. They certainly do, and they're always threatening to spill over onto the surface. And I think the people in positions of political power, both in China and Japan, not only realize this, but they actively play on it. So we saw, of course, the big spat over the Senkaku Islands, the Jiao Islands, whatever you want to call it, just at the time that both Xi Jinping was just coming into power as the new president in China, and just at the time that Shinzo Abe was coming in as the new prime minister here in Japan, both of whom were trying to obviously play, I think, to their domestic audience and show themselves as strong leaders. and it worked quite well. It certainly rallied a lot of people around their respective flags and got them cheering at the Emmanuel Goldstein for their 2 minutes of hate. And it served its purpose politically quite well. And you notice that the spats over those islands have died down considerably since that time, as it's not quite so politically convenient. Now they want to play a little bit nicer with each other. So that's the direction that things are trending in. But that's almost like a light switch that they can flick on and off, because that resentment certainly is there. It's fostered and it's played upon by both sides. And that's why it's at this point politically almost unthinkable that Japan would ever enter the orbit of China rather than the United States, because that resentment is so deep-seated that at this point it can't even be imagined that these people would want to actively collaborate.
You know, this has been one of the fastest hours I've ever lived through. It really has. But I would be completely remiss if I didn't ask you about the current situation in Fukushima, how it's affected everything over there, and then what's going on, how bad is it, just give us the rundown, James.
Well, that's a pretty tall order. I do a website called FukushimaUpdate.com, so people can go there on a regular basis, and that's updated several times a week with some of the latest stories. Basically, the situation at Fukushima is what it has been since the start of this disaster, which is that we have, of course, the three completely melted down cores in reactors 1, 2, and 3, and the corium, the mixture of radioactive fuel and elements that were there in the reactor cores, have all melted together and melted through the reactor down into the lining. They have no idea how much of the corium got out of the containment. They have no idea how far down it got. They're pretty sure it didn't actually breach through down to the groundwater. Yeah,
pretty sure,
exactly. But there's no way to tell at this point, given the technology that exists, because there are no robots that are sturdy enough to function in that high radioactive environment, and there's no way to image these cores yet. They're working on crazy ideas about cosmic rays as a way to try to image where the cores are lying and how they can even begin to approach them. TEPCO, the operators of the Fukushima plant that for some reason are still in charge ultimately of this cleanup, despite the fact that they've been so inept in every single not only the response to the disaster but the lead up to it, but they have a schedule for the removal of the fuel from reactor 1, both in the spent fuel pool and from the core itself. But that schedule keeps getting pushed back and pushed back. I wonder why. Is it because the technology doesn't exist to even begin approaching the cores? Because they don't know what they're doing? Because they don't have a handle on it? That's really the core of this issue. And all of the other things that we tend to hear about when we hear various stories about Fukushima tend to be the subsidiary results of those core problems, if you'll excuse the pun, which is the groundwater that's collecting in the wells and spilling out into the ocean, and they're trying to collect the most radioactive water and keep it on site, but then the tanks that they're storing it in sprout leaks, and all these the craziness that's going on there. But all of that is kind of peripheral to the main problem, which is the cores themselves, which they admit they don't really have a way of addressing at this point in time. So it is obviously not a pretty situation. And again, it affects so many different things, especially, of course, the people in the region who have been displaced, some of them still living in makeshift shelter facilities, families that have been split up. I mean, just horrific stories that have happened, of course, on top of the 20,000 deaths that resulted from the tsunami itself. So just a horrific time over there in that part of the country.
And you're there, why?
Well, that's obviously a good question. This is, so Fukushima is in the northeast section of the Honshu main island. So that's about 420 miles from where I am, about 700 kilometers. So the direct effects, for example, the fallout that was occurring in the first few weeks, the models show, and the sampling that we've been forwarded has shown that most of that fallout did occur in more of the Tokyo region, which again is several hundred kilometers away from where I am. So that initial fallout was obviously some of the most important part of this. What's been going on since that time is the ocean contamination, which continues, 300 tons of radioactive water spilling out into the ocean per day, which is why myself, my wife, my family, we don't eat fish, basically, unless we know exactly where it's coming from, and it doesn't come anywhere near the Pacific seaboard of Japan. Unfortunately, I live in one of the best places for seafood in the world where I can't eat any seafood, but that's just the way it goes.
That's tough, man. I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, it's a horrific thing. And unfortunately, again, there's no conceivable end to this, anytime in the near future, anytime in my lifetime, that there will ever be a point at which I would comfortably eat fish that's been fished out of the eastern seaboard of Japan. So again, there are significant lifestyle changes that have to occur here. But at the same time, I think there has been a tendency to overblow some of the stories and to cause panic where panic doesn't need to, I wouldn't say where panic doesn't need to take place, but sort of misplaced panic. And I think, for example, in the American context, to videos that went viral last year, for example, of the man I can't remember the name of the beach in San Francisco, where he has a Geiger counter and is walking around and showing the click rates, which of course are going off the charts, and he's saying, it's Fukushima, it's coming. Of course, not realizing that the particular beach he was standing on actually has a thorium vein, which is naturally occurring radioactive material norm. Oh, yeah. And so other people went in there with the same type of equipment to take samples of the radiation that was coming there. And they discovered through spectral analysis, it wasn't the cesium-137 fingerprint that we would expect from Fukushima. It was the so-called norm, naturally occurring radioactive material fingerprint from the spectral analysis. So people,
like that whole thing, you know how the press builds these things up. All it takes is one panic attack.
It's exactly right. But think about who benefits from that the most. It is the U.S. nuclear industry that has benefited the most from this, insofar as, for example, last year there was a huge containment leak at the Hanford site in Washington State that got very little press, even though it was, I think, 5 miles from a major river there in Washington State.
And the WIPP site in New Mexico, it got very little press.
Absolutely. Again, a major event that doesn't tend to get press because any nuclear news has to be Fukushima. So I think that the U.S., in the U.S. specifically, the way it's reported on tends to work out for the U.S. nuclear industry. And that's, the nuclear industry itself is a whole other topic that I'm sure we could spend another hour talking about.
I'd love to do that sometime. If you don't mind, we're going to stay in touch with you. And if you see a guy show up in a nuke suit with a cowboy hat, that will not be me, okay?
Okay.
James Corbett, thank you so much for your time. It is now, about 17 minutes after 2 a.m. Very kind of you to sit with us at this late hour for you. It's still morning for us. Thanks again.
I appreciate you having me on. Thank you very much.
Take care. James Corbett, CorbettReport.com, FukushimaUpdate.com. We'll be back with more. As we always come back for more, until one of us just doesn't exist anymore. This is Caravan to Midnight.